welcome to Two Chairs Talking. This is the 19th episode of our podcast, hosted by myself, David Grigg, and my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How's things today, Perry?
Oh, I'm very perplexed, David.
Perplexed? Why is that, Perry?
Oh, I've been living in Melbourne for 30 years and I still can't figure the weather out.
Oh, the weather.
Well, I know the Crowded House song, Four Seasons in One Day, but we certainly had that yesterday.
Yeah.
Had warmish, humid weather in the morning, then it cleared up, and then we had a monster of a hailstorm and rain yesterday afternoon. So we had hailstones that are about 2 to 2.5 centimetres, the big ones, 2 to 2.5 centimetres wide, and it really belted down. And I thought the cars outside are going to get absolutely dented all over the place. Yeah. And then I thought some of the windows in the skylights were going to break. Yeah. But we seemed to do okay. We got through. But it's just a weird place. Science fictional world. Or maybe it's the science fictional world that we're moving into, David.
It could be. I'm not sure. I think it is. We're all moving into a future that none of us experienced, or a world in which none of us experienced as a child. And unfortunately, I worry about my grandchildren and what kind of world they're going to grow up into, because it's not looking good.
I think we'll all be moving to Tasmania.
Yeah, well, it might get very full, yes. Next stop, Antarctica. Yeah. Anyway, all right, let's get this show on the road. So this is our 19th episode. We spent a very long time last episode talking about the books we liked from last year. We won't talk anywhere near that length of time today, I don't think. But we're going to start off with a bit of a chat about the movies and TV we liked from last year, briefly. So do you want to start that, Perry? Do you want to give me your, you know, five most favourite films or five most favourite TV shows you saw last year?
Well, five films. Had a bit of a think about this over the last couple of weeks, and I came to the conclusion I didn't really watch very much in the way of visual media last year, putting more of my efforts into reading. But as I slide down in towards retirement, I hopefully will have a bit more time and I might get to a few more films that I should do. My kids make it a point of ensuring that they get to see all of the 10 best film nominees for the Oscars. And I can safely say I think I've seen none of them.
Yeah.
So they've seen them all. Mm. I've seen none. And given that I can get a CD's discount down at the movies, I really should pull my finger out and get on with this. But anyway, that being said, 12 years it's taken, 12, 13 years it's taken, for the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe to get to the point where it reached Avengers Endgame in the first half of 2019. This was the follow-up to the Avengers Infinity War film from the previous year. The two of them were filmed together and basically they split it apart because it was just going to be too bloody long otherwise. As it was, I think it was 2.5, almost 3 hours. But by God, they did a hell of a lot of work getting it all coming together. And actually, I think they pulled it off not too badly. So I think they did overall a pretty good job of getting it there. Now, I know this is not these films are not to the taste of a lot of people, you know, superhero films, who cares? But I grew up reading comics, and I actually grew up reading a lot of Marvel comics back in the 70s and 80s. And also from the 60s, really.
Yeah, me too.
So this is sort of my background. It's not my only background in the genre, but it's a big part of the background of the material that I have. And I was pretty impressed with the way they went about it all. It was good. It was a big, hefty, spectacular film. Everything that you want from a piece of eye candy, really. You know you're not going to come away with it with lots of deep philosophical issues, but you're just going to come away with it and enjoying it. And I did. And I can't really ask more from a film more than that, really. No. So quite happy with that one.
Good.
The other one on the same vein was Captain Marvel. This was interestingly, the first of the Marvel films that had a female in the lead. Mm-hmm. I remember Captain Marvel from way back when he was a bloke. And so I must have missed the transition there from at some stage in the comics. And when I found out it was going to be a lady, I thought, hang on, have I missed something? But it worked really, really well. They picked a pretty good actor, Brie Larson, in the lead role. And it's obviously one of those initial films where they basically kick, like an origin film, they kick it all off. So you're getting a whole lot of background and you think, oh, yeah, a lot of this I've seen before. Again, it's still enjoyable. I've had about enough of the origin films, I must admit. They get to the point where they become a bit repetitious. But this one was interesting because of the fact it was the first one that had a female lead. So, and I think they did that well.
Yep, that sounds good.
Other ones, these are in no particular order, and I can't even remember the order in which I watched them. So, you know, I think Captain Marvel and Avengers Endgame were both in the first half of the year. Second half of the year, I watched All Is True. I think we discussed this on the podcast at some point. Film by Kenneth Branagh, dealing with the last days of Shakespeare after his theatre in London has burnt down, and he goes home to his wife, who's played by Judi Dench. Now, a lot of people complained about this because they said, oh, Judi Dench is too old. Oh, for God's sake. The woman's a great actor. Just let her get on with it. And she did a really good job. Yeah, she made, look, so what? I really don't get this whole point. If the end result works, why nitpick over this sort of stuff? It just doesn't make any sense to me. No. And I've got another nitpick, another thing I want to get about nitpicks in a minute as well. So I thought it was a good film, really enjoyable, slow, but that was okay. And I just thought it fitted and it worked well. I liked it. Four of us that went, wife and I and another couple went, we all liked it. Can't ask more than that.
No.
The other nitpicking film another film that a lot of people nitpick about is Knives Out, which is an excellent little, it's a manor house murder mystery. It's not a closed room, but it's a manor house murder mystery in the sense that there's an ensemble cast, a family, all get together for a writer's 85th birthday. Next morning, he's found dead, what looks like murder, because his throat's been cut. Generally, pretty good instance of that. That's actually going to be murder. The police come in, and along with the police is Daniel Craig playing this detective with a dodgy American South accent. A lot of nitpicking's been done about Daniel Craig's acting in this, in the sense that they said the accent's just terrible and it's just a travesty. I'm of the view that this is part of the whole fun of the whole thing. It's basically he may well be putting it on to basically make people feel uncomfortable or not understand what it is he's doing or think that he's less intelligent than he actually is. And it's got a very good ensemble cast other than Daniel Craig. It's got Christopher Plummer. It's got a number of different people in it that are really quite interesting, and it's worthwhile having a look at it. One of the guys who plays Captain Marvel in The Avengers is in this film, and this is a bit of a change because he plays a sort of a rich playboy in this who's... Well, they're all a bit dodgy. They've all got their own. They're all on the make. Everybody in this film from the family. So it's that one's quite excellent. The last one, John Wick Chapter 3.
Oh, gold.
Now, I'm not sure whether you'll be watching the John Wick films.
No,
David. These are based on a series of graphic novels. John Wick is a retired assassin. Who has got out of the game in the first film, and he's brought back into it again because somebody believes that he either has something or knows something, and it's just after his wife has died, and her last wish was to give him a dog. The guys who come to try and kill him don't kill him, but kill his dog, and that's it. He's off, and it's still basically running from the first film. I thought I'd watch the first film again during the year and trying to keep a body count game up after about the first 10 minutes, waste of time. Now, this isn't sort of big blood splatter all over the place, so you're not seeing heads explode, guts falling out, all that sort of stuff. But a lot of guys, a lot of people are killed in this, or all shot. Mm. So if you can't handle that, not worthwhile watching it. But it's like Westerns in the past, You know, we're based, or murder mysteries. Oh, sorry, not murder, war movies. I don't believe this was as violent as Saving Private Ryan. The first 15, 20 minutes or half hour of Saving Private Ryan are really, really harrowing. I watched them again just recently the other night. It just came on as it as they were getting as they were on the landing craft coming into the shore, and I thought, oh, I'll just watch 5 minutes of this. I watched the next half hour or so until that first act finishes, and it's. That's fairly amazing stuff. Mm. This is not at that level, but a lot of people would say, well, it's just mindless, relentless violence. Well, yeah, but hell, I don't mind.
Fair enough.
So that's it. Okay. Don't mind.
All right. So those are your movies, yeah?
Yep, that's
all right. Well, we'll go on to TV in a bit, but I'm just looking at my movie list, and the problem for us is really that my wife and I never... My wife and I never go to see movies in the cinema these days, basically because we're so deaf that we can't follow most of the dialogue unless there's captions. And so almost everything we watch has got to be off a DVD or one of the streaming services and so on, which have got closed captions in. So that limits us a fair bit. So what did I see, though? I saw Mortal Engines, which is based on the Philip Reeve series of books. I mentioned Fever Crumb last time, I think, which was a prequel to this. But it was pretty well done. Hugo Weaving is in it as someone who starts out looking as though he's a hero and everybody should look up to, and then turns out to be the villain. Some good young actors in. I'm just trying to figure out their names again. Hester Shaw, who's like the main young female character, is played by Hira Hilmar. And young Tom Natsworthy is played by Robert Sheehan. I don't know either of those actors before this. They seem new to me. But it was pretty well done. It tries to capture an awful lot of the Mortal Engines series of books in one relatively short film, but does a pretty good job. This is the concept where you have these huge cities which are going around what used to be the sea beds, where when the seas used to be there, traveling around on these traction engines and snapping up smaller cities. And it's the special effects and so on in this in the film went on pretty well. I thought it was a pretty good job. And the other sort of full-length movie I saw for the first time was First Man, which has got Ryan Gosling playing, it's a biopic of Neil Armstrong. And Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong as this very emotionally buttoned up character, which apparently Armstrong was. That was pretty well done. I thought that was good. There's some very good moments in it. The anguish that all the astronaut corps felt after the Apollo 1 disaster, where the three astronauts were burnt alive in the capsule, that was very affecting. And that's the point at which you realize how much Armstrong kind of has got to button down his emotions and not let himself let them out. Anyway, that was good. And I think almost everything else I saw was rewatches of things that we then talked about on the podcast. So there was the film Passengers, the film Moon with Sam Rockwell, the Alien movies, Blade Runner movies, Ex Machina, which we talked about on the podcast. Those are the films that I enjoyed last year. So TV series, what's your...
Again, as I mentioned about film, I didn't watch a lot of TV this year. Generally, my television watching deals with the news and live sport, again, because I'm concentrating a lot on reading and I'm not getting through a lot of television. I know there's massive amounts out of it out there and I'm way, way behind. But anyway, I'll do the best I can and see how we go. Now, the big one, certainly in the genre for this year, was the final season of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Had high expectations. I was okay with the way it ended up, but I thought they rushed it. I don't quite know why they felt they had to go it all in seven episodes or whatever it was, why they couldn't string it out a little bit more. It just didn't make a lot of sense to me. There were one or two episodes which were absolutely brilliant, really, really good. And they were almost where they were marking time between one big action sequence and the next. And they were some of the best stuff that they produced in the whole of the whole of the season. But then they went in and just rushed everything at the end and just pushed it all the way right through. Mm. I wasn't overly fussed about the final result and the final ending. A lot of people still haven't seen it, so I won't put spoilers in. I was okay with that. I really wanted it, and I suppose everybody else really wanted it, to take its time, because a lot of the really good pieces that were associated with Game of Thrones dealt with the interactions of the characters and the political machinations that went on in the background. Yep. A lot of that was lost this time. It was full-on action, and you didn't really get much of a view, as much as you wanted to, of what was happening and what the interactions were. A lot of the main characters died, as you could expect, mm-hmm. which is the thing about Martin. He doesn't have a problem about killing main characters off. But I think that overall, looking back on it now, you can really see where things started to veer off to one side, and that was when they ran out of original George Martin material.
Yes.
When they got to that point, things didn't work as well as it might have done, or didn't work as well as it could have done in the beginning. Lessons learnt, unfortunately, it's gone. People might have put up a petition to have the last season reshot.
It's not going to happen.
It's done and dusted. Another one in the, another two in the genre, really, For All Mankind. We mentioned this one a little bit. This one's the alternate history that breaks off in June 1969, when the Russians actually land a man on the moon a month before the Americans. And this then spurs massive changes all the way through American society. They believe they have to keep up with the Russians, so the space race continues. And it's quite a good continuance of that alternate history theme, where it basically changes at a certain point and then it moves on through. And it worked out quite well. There were a couple of times when I thought it got overly sentimental, but it's made in America. The Americans love sentimentality.
Schmaltz.
So overall, I thought it was pretty good. I think it is certainly worth a science fiction fan watching it.
Mm-hmm.
It has got enough interesting points to it to be of great interest. Another one in the genre, is Mr. Mercedes. This is a series of, I think he's probably up to series three now, which shows you how far behind I am, because just this year I've got into watching season two. So I watched season one last year. This is based on the series of three novels written by Stephen King between about 2014 and 2016, which is referred to as the Bill Hodges trilogy. Mm-hmm. That's basically the books Mr. Mercedes, Finders Keepers, and End of Watch. So again, what they've done is they've taken the title of the first book and put that in as the whole of the series title. Mm-hmm. It's a crime, supernatural, horror mix written by King from the original. So they've got three novels for which they do one season per novel. And so this first season deals with the first book. It starts off with a fairly gruesome scene where a young man steals a very large Mercedes-Benz sedan and drives it and plows it into a whole group of people waiting overnight and camping out overnight for an employment fair, because they're all basically out of work and they're all lined up to go to a job fair the next morning to see if they can get a job. He plows all into them, kills 8 or 10 of them, and then drives off, dumps the car, and is never found. They can't ever work out who did it. Nothing seems to make any sense in the sense of how he got the car, why he did it, who it was. And the lead detective, Bill Hodges, he ends up retiring. And he's home one day wandering around in his retirement, not knowing what to do. And he starts receiving messages from somebody purporting to be the killer. And as he gets more and more information and tracks into it, he figures out that, yes, the guy does know things that were never released to the public, and so therefore must be the killer. And so he starts trying to track him down. It's a good sequence, well acted, well scripted, well directed, TV series to watch. I thought it was excellent, and I'm going to be carrying on and watching seasons 2 and 3 when I get to them. And that's about me for that.
Oh, well, with same here with me in that For All Mankind was definitely on my best of list for last year. I haven't quite got to the last episode yet, but almost to the last episode, so I've been enjoying it a lot. We also watched it's also on Apple TV Plus, the morning show or the morning wars, depending on how you describe it. Which is the one with Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. That was terrific. I mean, there were parts of it partway through that where it seemed to flag a little, but it suddenly comes to a terrific conclusion at the end. So that certainly, I think that was very well worth watching. The acting was very good. Steve Carell, Billy Crudup, Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon, a couple of other really good people in there. And so, obviously, Apple have paid quite a bit of money to hire these actors and these top-notch actors, and the production values are very, very high. So that was great. Also saw on Amazon Prime Good Omens, which I thought was okay, based on the Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman book. But I didn't really think this TV series did justice to the book, to be honest. But it was okay. I talked about on the podcast before about The Boys, which is another Amazon Prime. That's an Amazon Prime original, and that was very good. But I won't talk about it anymore since I've talked about that before. And I saw another series on Amazon Prime called Goliath, which was very good. And that has what's the name of the actor? Billy Bob Thornton as a sort of down and out lawyer who's had to leave his law firm, which he helped set up. With William Hurt, who was his partner. And William Hurt in this place is really creepy character. Oh, God, he's so creepy. he's got a very badly burnt face from his service in the Vietnam War. And but he rules this law firm with a lot of control. And but he's weird. He always likes to stay in darkened rooms. And he then starts this really creepy relationship with a young woman who works for the law firm. And, it's very good acting, but he's a really creepy character. Anyway, so that was good. It's called Goliath. And there's several other seasons of that, which I may or may not watch. Not sure yet. So that was my TV for the year.
All right. Okay, good. Well, plenty to look forward to as well in 2020.
There's so much stuff, as you say. There's so much streaming material now. It's impossible for anyone to keep up. And there's several series which I'd like to catch up with, which I haven't yet. But maybe I'll catch up with them this year. It would be good.
So you can't keep up with the books, you can't keep up with the films, and you certainly can't keep up with the television.
That's exactly right.
So you just do the best you can, and that's
it. That's it.
One
only has a certain amount of attention span. That's true.
Find something you like and just stay with it. That's
indeed.
It.
The Hugo Time Machine. And we're dealing with the year. We're going back in the Hugo Time Machine to the year 1960, when the awards were given for works released in 1959. And the winner of the novel category was Starship Troopers by Robert A. Heinlein. I think Perry has managed to reread this recently and has some thoughts.
Yes, I do have some thoughts on this one. I don't know whether this is where the whole subgenre of military SF started, but it's certainly considered to be one of the exemplars of that particular subgenre. Now, it's not a subgenre that I particularly like very much. And let me explain what I mean by military SF. This is basically science fiction where the major emphasis is on soldiers and warfare. A lot of it is pitched at a point where either the soldiers are mechanically or medically enhanced to be able to fight future wars, either on Earth, in the solar system, or against alien races somewhere in the galaxy. When I was reading this, I remembered that old joke about somebody putting up a campaign poster and saying, come and join the interstellar space force, travel to strange exotic places, meet strange exotic races and kill them.
Yes.
Because that's basically what this is all about. Heinlein, this is his second Hugo Award, previously won it for Double Star. Here he is pretty much, and I think obviously drawing on his wartime experience where he was, I think, either in the Marines or the Army, one or the other, that basically he had to undergo, he had to undergo boot camp. And the first half of this particular book is all about the lead character who undergoes boot camp training. And, oh, God, it's tedious.
Yes, it is. Basically, it's very tedious.
There's a few instances where there are points where you can see that he is attempting to write a science fiction novel by putting little pointers in about, we're fighting, they came down and they attacked us and blew up Buenos Aires and blew up bits of California or something along those lines. So you get the idea that there is this interstellar force from belonging to another race that's come in, attacked Earth, tried to take it over, and the authorities on Earth have decided to try and mobilise as many people as they possibly can to try and get out there and fight these particular races. You learn nothing about them in the first half of the book, nothing at all. It is purely and simply that they're there, they're the enemy, we don't know why, that's it. And off it goes, and it's basically told from the point of view of this guy that's in boot camp who goes along. After about a couple of weeks, he decides he really doesn't like it very much and he wants to get out. Somebody convinces him, no, look, you just got to hang on. You're getting there. You'll get there. Maybe it's 6 weeks he's in. You'll get there. And he suddenly realizes that, yes, he's over the top of the hump and, yes, he is going to be there. Then near the end of his time when he's in boot camp, he decides that, I don't really want to do this. I'll just do my time and then I'll leave. And somebody convinces him, oh, look, you're really good. You could be fantastic. You could become a career soldier. So he decides to sign up without thought. Yeah, okay, I'll do that. So he signs up to be a career soldier. Okay, motivation's not really too flash in this, I thought. Anyway, keep on going. So then he basically gets through boot camp and then he goes off and they go off to fight the aliens, the bugs, as they refer to. Now, he's got a sort of interesting idea about this alien race, but he doesn't develop it. You have no idea why they've attacked the Earth. You have no idea what their motivations are. And all you get is countless battles of this guy when he's with all of his bunch of mates going down and trying to blast the crap out of all these aliens all over the place. But in the meantime, all the way through, you get these massive lectures.
Yes, lectures, yeah.
On philosophical problems. Everybody that's in authority decides they're going to tell everybody else and they lecture them. And normally what you would do is, in a book like this, is you'd sort of have a little bit about it and then you'd sort of have a little bit of a counter-argument and then carry on. These things go on for four pages.
Yes.
And it's verbatim lecture. Mm. And it's been said since that this really wasn't Heinlein's point of view. Oh, yeah, you could have fooled me. Absolutely. It seems like it's bleedingly obvious. I don't know how the hell he could have written it without it being his. Mm. And it's consistent all the way right through.
Mm.
Now, there are some things I really don't like about this particular book, other than the fact that I don't like it overall, but there's some little pieces of it where it seems to be, and he doesn't really tell you that this is the exact case, that in order for you to get the vote You have to actually serve in the military.
Yes.
And, well, that's, I'm completely against that. I'm basically for full and complete suffrage all the way along the line. Everybody that's over a certain age should be allowed to vote. Race, colour, creed, gender, I don't care. You should be allowed to vote if you're a citizen of the particular country. That doesn't seem to be the case here. So it's a really strange book that is a rah-rah patriotism novel. But I'd like to put it to you, David, because we've spoken about Robert A. Heinlein's Juveniles. I think this is actually a juvenile novel.
Mm, yeah.
I don't believe it's an adult novel at all.
Mm.
He's dealing with an army situation in which there are no women.
No. Oh, there are, but they're not.
Well, there are, but they just flip.
There's no romantic relationships, if I recall rightly. Yeah.
Well, there's no swearing. Mm. There's no sex.
Mm. No.
And there's absolutely nothing. And he never mentions sex.
No.
At all.
No.
You know, oh, there's some girls around, and I had a look at them, and, oh, they were really lovely.
Mm.
You're 18. You're about to die. Give me a break. You know, I don't need massive descriptions of what's going on, but it actually at least acknowledges the fact that the guy's got some sexual leanings or some urges, but nothing at all. So all in all, I thought it was pretty disappointing. It's, as I said, it's probably an earlier version of military science fiction. I have read some other military science fiction as it's coming out now, and that's certainly changed. It has certainly changed. The best of the stuff, like the recent material by Linda Nagata or Martha Wells, has a humanist approach to it. Yes, these guys are weaponized up to the max. They've got armor. They've got artificial intelligence helping them out. They've got weapons all over the place. But the writers these days talk about the conflicts associated with actually being that particular being in that particular place and doing that particular type of work.
Hmm.
Heinlein has absolutely no doubts whatsoever about what his main character is going to do and why his main character is doing it. And not to me. I didn't like it. I didn't think it wasn't there for me.
No, there's no shades of grey. As you say, I tried to reread it and found myself skipping all those long, long bits of lectures where Heinlein's propounding his particular philosophy of the world, and no, it's too much. Yeah. So, but we can move on to the, was it novella, novelette, Flannis Algernon?
Well, basically, we have to be aware of the fact that what happened in 1959 was they have a novelette and a short story category. 1960, for works published in 1959, they just basically lumped it all in together and just called it short fiction.
Mm.
So we have in the short fiction category, the winner was Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes, published in fantasy and science fiction. Now, I really must make a point about this. In the past, we've seen that Astounding, edited by John Campbell in the 1950s, pretty much swept the pool with all the either nominees or winners all the way right through for the Hugo Awards for up to this point. But in this particular year, there are, let me see, what have we got? One, two, three, four, five short pieces nominated. Flowers for Algernon, fantasy and science fiction. The Alley Man, Philip Jose Farmer, fantasy and science fiction. The Pie Man, Alfred Bester, fantasy and science fiction. The Man Who Lost the Sea, fantasy and science fiction.
Mm.
And the last one, Cat and Mouse by Ralph Williams in Astounding. So one out of the five for Astounding. It's hardly surprising then that the winner of the Best Professional Magazine was fantasy and science fiction in this, although Astounding was nominated. So this was a pretty good year for this particular magazine, and it did really quite well. Now I'll briefly talk about a couple of the other nominees at this point, because I actually got a chance to read the whole lot of them, which is quite good. The Cat and Mouse by Ralph Williams. Ralph Williams is not a name I knew. I looked him up. He only wrote about a dozen stories. Died at the age of 45 in a boating accident. So might have had a very long career. Didn't get there. Cat and Mouse is a classic Campbell Astounding story. Absolutely classic. It's Campbell liked the idea of humans interacting with aliens. And even though the aliens were really smart and maybe even technologically better situated than the humans always came out on top. And this is basically pretty much what happens in this instance. Mm. It deals with this guy who's an outdoorsman living a self-sufficient life in Alaska who comes across a gateway into another world.
Mm.
Shades of Big Front Yard from last time. And he enters this world and gets attacked by aliens. And they start coming into our world to try to get to him. And he basically goes in and cleans them all up.
Mm.
All good stuff. It's fantastic. Now, the others, The Alley Man by Philip Jose Farmer, I didn't get this story at all. Didn't get it. It's about a Neanderthal that's living in the American South and seems to have maintained his pedigree as a Neanderthal for the last 500,000 years.
Mm.
Yeah, didn't make any sense. The Pie Man by Alfred Bester. There's something about Alfred Bester that a lot of the time, I really like the Man Who Killed Mohammed. This one, I just don't get.
Mm.
It's a gimmicky story about an irrational man trying to set a pattern in Earth's population using irrational means.
Mm.
Didn't make sense to me. The last one, Theodore Sturgeon's The Man Who Lost the Sea, could very easily have won this category if it hadn't been up against Flowers for Algernon.
Mm.
Well, it's a very interesting story about man's first expedition to Mars. 80% of the way through the book, you have no idea that's what it's about.
Mm.
But it all comes together in the last 20% of the short story, so in about the last 4 or 5 pages. Oh, that's what it was all about. I wonder what he was getting to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then it all comes, and you look back, oh, I think I'll go back and reread that again. So you read it again, oh, okay.
Mm.
Now, if you can get a story where when you get to the end and you suddenly hit a realisation that, that's pretty good, I'll go back and read it again, I think he's on a winner. Sturgeon was a great writer.
Yeah, really good.
And he did a wonderful piece here. This is just fantastic.
Mm.
But Flowers for Algernon. I've rabbited on a bit about these stories. Do you want to talk about Flowers for Algernon?
Yeah, it's a very touching story in a way. It's cleverly constructed. It's done as a series of diary entries. He calls them progress reports. And they're all written from the first person point of view because they're diary entries from this young man who's intellectually disabled, we would say these days. He's certainly mentally deficient. And so
he's got an IQ of 68.
Something like that. And his spelling and his grammar's all over the place. But we gather from this that he's being recruited for some sort of scientific program. And we eventually discover that the program is to try to increase his intelligence by surgical means. And they're testing these techniques on a mouse and getting it to run more and more complicated mazes. And they manage to increase the intelligence of this mouse 3 times and can therefore solve very complex mazes. And the main character can't solve the mazes at the start. And so as these little diary entries go on and on and on, and he goes through this surgery, we start to see his intelligence pick up, and he teaches himself how to spell properly and learns how to do grammar properly and gets more and more intelligent. And we see that in the progress of these progress reports. But alas, it's not permanent. And the poor little mouse starts to go crazy and eventually dies because of the effects of this procedure that's been done on it. And at the peak of his intelligence, the main character knows that he's going to go through the same arc, which is really quite tragic. And then there's a series of progress reports as his intelligence ebbs away. So it's really beautifully done, I thought, and very very sort of moving concept and cleverly done. The way these progress reports build up to carry you through this arc of low intelligence to high intelligence to then down to back down to low intelligence again. And so, yeah, I liked it a lot. What about you, Perry?
Yeah, so did I. I thought it beautifully steered away from sentimentality. There wasn't... You did not have the idea that this was a sentimental, mushy, schmaltzy story at all.
Mm.
But it's very poignant, and because you know what's going to happen. And he knows, as you state, he knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And he can do nothing about it other than to watch himself diminishing in every day.
Mm.
And he actually goes back near the end and he reads a scientific paper he wrote when he was intelligent and can't understand it. And then he picks up a book and starts to read it, and he thinks his eyes have gone until he realizes that it's written in German. He's forgotten how to read German. Mm. It's a classic science fiction story, probably would be considered one of the top 10, 20 science fiction stories ever written. Daniel Keyes was sort of a visitor to the genre, didn't either do very much in the genre at all. And so he was just flitted in, flitted out, wrote a fantastic story, which he then turned into a novel later on, which I think it might have, that novel may have won a major award down the track somewhere, I'm not sure. But there was a film made of it called Charlie.
Charlie, yes.
Which unfortunately delved as heavily into the sentimentality as it possibly could, and was a bit sick-making because of it. But this is an excellent story, and it's one that I think any student of the genre should really know about and have read.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, Starship Troopers, a student of the genre should know about it, but I wouldn't recommend them reading it.
No, that's where the difference lies. That's right.
You need to know about Starship Troopers purely and simply because of its impact that it has later on down the track. I mean, you can't see Joe Haldeman's Forever War being written without Starship Troopers having been written. And this is, like, Starship Troopers is a response to the Second World War, which was all rah, rah, rah. Forever War is Joe Haldeman's response to the Vietnam War, which was, what the bloody hell were we doing?
Yeah.
Look at the impact it had on us. And that was the difference that it made. But as much as I may dislike Starship Troopers, it had a profound impact on the genre, and therefore you can't really ignore it.
Indeed. I realise that we didn't actually mention the other nominees for the novel category. The only one of which I think is worth mentioning at all is The Sirens of Titan by Kurt Vonnegut, which is...
Dorside by Gordon R. Dixon.
Well, I've never read that, so I can't comment, but is that a good book?
Oh, no.
Okay, really. Well, fair enough.
No, but it's a space opera, and it basically set off a whole series of books that he wrote about the Dorsai, and that also had an impact because these Dorsai are like mercenaries. So, again, this is space opera with another military science fiction bent to it. And so, anyway,
But I think The Sirens of Titan is worth mentioning because I think it was Kurt Vonnegut's first novel, is that right? Certainly his first novel in the science fiction sort of category. And it's quite a weird one, which is very satirical in tone. And it's a long while since I've read it. I didn't have the time to reread it for today's episode. But I think it's notable that came up against Starship Troopers that year, but didn't win.
Interesting also to note that in that same year, Eric Frank Russell's Next of Kin was published, as well as Robert Bloch's Psycho.
Ah, right.
And Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House.
Okay.
So it's interesting that at this point, when you look at the four nominees and Leinster, Mark Phillips is a pseudonym of Randall Garrett and Lawrence M. Jennifer, and you've got Vonnegut. So these are all old white male stuff, writing male-centric science fiction. That was what was in vogue at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And as we have to recall, the Hugo Awards are voted on by members of the World Science Fiction Convention. At the time in the 1960s, I would suspect that the vast bulk of the members of that World Science Fiction Convention, because this one was held in Pittsburgh, would have been white American males, young. They voted for what they read at the time, and regardless of what was out there, they would probably not have referred to The Haunting of Hill House as being, or Psycho, as fitting the genre.
No, I don't think they do, really. Psycho isn't fantasy or science fiction at all, really, is it?
No. It has
horror elements, maybe. You could call it horror.
More a horror novel and horror elements.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, maybe that's why it got dropped out, or they weren't interested. But I think that's just the way that it was. I'm only making a supposition here, and I'm probably talking through my hat, but hey, what the hell, that's the way I see it.
Sure. It's probably also worth, before we finish this segment, to mention that the best dramatic presentation went to The Twilight Zone, which I think was probably pretty new at the time.
Yes, I think
Rod Sterling's series, yeah.
Yeah, I think they changed the rules of this because it had been for best film or something, and I think they changed it to best dramatic presentation allow for the fact, put television in.
Yeah.
Later on, things change again until they basically split it so that a particular episode of a particular TV series could receive a particular award.
Mm.
That happens later on, but sure. We'll get to that in, I don't know, 10 or 20 years, whenever we get down to through the rest of all of these lists.
Yeah, well, that's right, sure. So earlier on, Perry was talking about the TV series Mr. Mercedes, which is based on the Bill Hodges series by Stephen King around the character Bill Hodges. But there's another book by Stephen King called The Outsider, which in some ways could be seen as the fourth book in that series. It includes at least one of the characters from the earlier series, and that's The Outsider. I think both Perry and I have read this recently, but I'll let Perry lead off in his impressions of the book. So is this still part of a mystery crime series, Perry, or not?
Okay, yeah, but The Outsider by Stephen King, published in 2018. As you said, it's sort of the fourth book in the Bill Hodges trilogy. Bill Hodges isn't in it because, spoiler alert here, I'm sorry to have to tell you, the poor old guy dies in the third book of his trilogy. But he's offside a Holly Gibney, who he's taken under his wing in that particular trilogy of books, makes an appearance in this novel as well. Now, the book starts in the fictional town of Flint City in Oklahoma, middle America. This is another one of those classic Stephen King towns, 10 to 20,000 people, country, all of the standard American middle-class country town values, everything that you've come to expect from his Castle Rock stuff or his Derry in Maine, those two other fictional towns that he's made up. This is very similar to that. Everybody seems to know everybody else, and everybody just gets along and off they go. Now, the book starts with a man walking his dog. The dog runs off into a park. He follows the dog, and the dog finds something. He sees a bit of blood splattered up against a tree, and he follows the trail, and he comes across a scene that is very, very gruesome. A young boy, about 12 or 13, has been brutally murdered. He's had his throat ripped out, and various other things have been done to him that are fairly shocking. He contacts the police. The police come in, have a look, start taking fingerprints. There's a weapon that's been used there, a branch of a tree, and they're able to take fingerprints from that. They're able to get DNA from the body as well. And they start canvassing the local area, asking people whether they saw anything. And all these people start coming forward. A young kid saw a man walking out of the trees, covered in blood, getting into a white van and driving off. Did the police ask her, did she know him? Yes, she did. They find somebody else who saw the man from across the street walking out of the woods, getting into the van. Did she know who he was? Yes, she did as well. The man they track goes to a local strip club, walks in, talks to the bouncer and says that he needs to go into the bathroom and clean up because he's had a nosebleed. He's got blood all over him. So he goes in there and he goes into the bathroom, comes back out having changed all his clothes and walks out past the bouncer, says hello to the bouncer again, goes outside, asks for a cab, and the bouncer says, no, there's a cab out there already. So he goes out and gets the cab. The bouncer recognises him. The cab driver recognises him, drops the man off at the train station where he stands at the ticket office and turns and faces the camera that he knows is up in the corner and stares directly at it, turns back to the ticket office, seems to change his mind and then walks out of the train station and is never seen again. Everybody has a consistent view of who this person is, and it is the coach of the local high school baseball team. This is a bit shocking because this guy's a fine, upstanding member of the community, but seems to have committed a massively brutal murder of this young boy. The police get all the evidence together, they argue the toss over what they're going to do, and then decide that the best thing for them to do is to arrest him in front of a whole crowd of people at the baseball game. Their thinking is, well, it's better that everybody sees that it's him, that he's handcuffed, and that he's taken out to the car. So they do all that, they take him in, they put him in jail. He's completely nonplussed, of course, as is everybody else, because this is completely out of character. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So he then gets a hold of his lawyer, and he tells his lawyer that he was nowhere near the town when this boy was killed, and is able to tell the lawyer and the police that he was actually at a literary conference in a town 70 kilometres away. And after a bit of investigation, the lawyer and the lawyer's private detective determined that there is that teacher, the coach, at the literary conference, standing up asking a question, and he's picked up on local television and filmed, and it's quite obvious that it's him. So somehow or other, this guy's in two places at once. So what we have with Stephen King here is what starts off as being a classic crime problem. How can this guy be in two places at once? What's going on? It doesn't seem to make any sense. Things escalate. And well, are we allowed to give spoilers here?
Yeah, honestly,
why not? Anyway, so the police don't let him go because they've got a lot of evidence. They've got DNA evidence. They've taken a swab. He's got the same blood group. He's got everything that's associated with him at the crime scene. But he's also at this other place at exactly the same time. He goes for his arraignment in the local courthouse. There's people everywhere. There's police. There's a press all over the place. There's cameras everywhere. And as he's walking down the path heading down towards the club, the courthouse, the older brother of the young boy that was murdered steps out with a gun and shoots him and shoots a couple of other people and then is shot by the police officer at the same time. The coach is basically lying there on the ground. He's been shot in the neck, and so he's basically hit the jugular. He doesn't have very long to live. The police officer comes to him, presses down on his neck to give himself as much time, and says, "Did you do it? Did you kill this boy?" And his last words are, "No, I didn't. I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't me." And he dies. And then there's all the acrimony over the fact that, was he really innocent? Was he not? And then slowly but surely, as the police officer, because he fired a gun, he is put on leave for a couple of weeks. So he has to go and sit while they investigate what happened to make sure that everything's going okay. But he can't sleep. He can't get to the. He can't come to an arrangement in his head about what happened. And he goes and sees the wife, who absolutely hates his guts, of course, because she blames him for the guy dying. And she's got two young children, two young girls. And so she hates this guy. But he finally convinces her and he finally convinces the lawyers that there is more to this than meets the eye and that they have to do something about it. And the wife says, "Why? Why should I? Why should I help you after you killed my husband?" And the policeman says, "Well, if it wasn't him, it was somebody else. So what if this guy does it to some other person? We can't let that happen." So he gets a change of heart, this police officer. He was cold early on. He thought absolutely and utterly had this guy to rights. He had him completely and utterly in the frame. But then he has now come to the point where he's going, actually, there are some doubts about this. And so the book progresses over the time and he finds out that with connections that he's making through the use of the coach's lawyer and also the PI that was the private investigator that was employed to help find out a whole lot of information, he starts finding out that there were other connections that go on. Where did the van come from that he was driving? Didn't make any sense. And he starts making connections with where the coach went on holidays and where he went and where he saw. But it slowly starts moving from being a straight crime novel into becoming a supernatural, almost horror novel as it goes on. And this is a sort of classic Stephen King sort of style, Stephen King territory, basically. He wrote a book. He's written two out-and-out crime novels that I can name. They are The Colorado Kid and Joyland, both of which he wrote for a small paperback publisher called Hard Case Crime. Hard Case Crime publishes new hard detective, hard crime stuff, you know, PIs, guys that are in trouble, basically the Jim Thompson, Elmore Leonard style of James Lee Burke style of novel. And King has written a couple of books in that for that particular publisher because he likes that style a lot. But King is a supernatural or horror writer. Colorado Kid has a setup which is a touch similar to this. They can't work out why this guy died on this particular beach when an hour or 30 minutes previously he'd been 80 or 100 miles away. How did he get here? That's never explained in The Colorado Kid. But here, it's like he's almost had that thing ticking on in the back of his head, thinking, maybe I didn't explain that one properly. Maybe I better do something like this to be able to come up with something. And the thing I can come up with is as a supernatural element to it. I look at this as being certainly Later King. Well, it is Later King, but you know what I mean.
Later King.
It's not Later King. It's not one of his top notch. Back when he was writing in the 70s and 80s, he was phenomenal. He could do a 200-300 word description of a particular character, and you had that character down pat. You knew exactly where they fitted in society, what they were, what they did, almost what their history was, and you could almost get the point of everything that you needed to know about this particular character in that shiny piece of description.
Yep.
He doesn't do that as well now as he used to. That's fair enough. The guy's in his 70s, he's written, I don't know, 70, 80 books. I don't know how many he's written. Massive number. So you can understand that maybe his powers are falling away. That it isn't to say that this book is a dud. It isn't by any stretch of the imagination. It's really quite good. It gets a 4.0 on Goodreads, and that's pretty high because there's a lot of people around who basically, if they don't like something, they'll give it 0 or 1. And, oh, this is a book for me. I couldn't finish it. I'll give it 0. So it's good stuff, worth reading. You've got to have a bit of a stomach for the early part of the violence, but as it's being made into has been made into a 10-part miniseries for television, starring Australia's Ben Mendelsohn in the lead role, and that's now showing on Foxtel. First two episodes have already been shown. Yeah. Third one was being shown today.
Oh, I must catch up.
I should be watching it, David.
I must catch up with it.
You must try and catch up with it. And that's handled very well. So if you want to basically read the book before you get to watching that series, it's quite good. I'd recommend it. I liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I liked it too. It's good. And it kind of works as a continuation of the Bill Hodges series, which themselves, like the first two books in that, maybe the first one and a half books in that, are just straight sort of crime, and then the supernatural element, he can't stop himself. The supernatural element starts to creep in into the end of the second
book.
That's
who he is.
Right at the end of the second book, and then the third book goes whole hog. But it's okay. Yeah. Anything he writes is good, and even at his worst, I think Stephen King's a damn good writer. So. I was thinking about some of his he never really wrote SF, did he? He wrote fantasy, or he wrote horror, or he wrote, you know, crime, I suppose. And it's a long while since I read it, but I remember one book he wrote called Dolores Claiborne, which is just straight fiction, really. There's a crime involved in it, but you wouldn't really call it a mystery novel. But that's well worth reading, that little book. If you haven't come across it, but it's good. I haven't read everything that he wrote by any means, and I tend to steer away from the pure horror stuff.
I'm not sure anybody's read everything that he has, other than himself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But anyway, there's bound to be people that have, but yeah. I haven't.
I mean, there are certainly huge gaps in my reading of Stephen King. I've never read The Shining, for example. which is probably a bit of a gap.
Yes, you should read that. I mean, that's where he was inventive. I hadn't seen what he had done. I hadn't seen what he did there done by anybody else. And it's the gradual disintegration of a particular character and the malevolent aspect of the hotel in which he's the caretaker. We've probably all seen the Kubrick film, and he hates the Kubrick film, said it had the emphasis completely and utterly on the wrong thing.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's anyway, I've got a lot to catch up with Stephen King.
Well, yeah, there's yards of it that you have to basically, or meters, as we should say, that you should read. But anyway, I'd recommend this book. I've tentatively slotted it in already in my best five horror books for the year.
Oh, yes.
Not that I'm going to be reading probably huge numbers, but it would certainly fit there. It would have fitted last year without any problems whatsoever. So I'm comfortable about putting it there so far. It may get dropped out if I read a heck of a lot of other stuff. But
sure, it's early days yet.
It's early days, but it was. It's a classic King novel that rollicks along. There aren't dull patches in it. There's always something going on that you can enjoy. And even at 560, 600 pages, whatever it is, it doesn't feel like a 500 or 600 page
rolls
novel.
By, yeah.
It just rollicks along. That's great. Yeah,
indeed.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's probably enough for this episode. We've gone over an hour, I think, again. So we'll leave it at that. And we'll catch up again with you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, David. Bit of reading to do before then. We've got a few plans on what we're doing.
Yeah, and a couple of movies to see. I think we've got plans for doing some more movie reviews, including a movie that. You have some thoughts about a particular movie, and I couldn't even get beyond the first 20 minutes of it. So we'll see how we go. We'll mention that later. But
well, it's not going to be terribly good if you've only watched the first 20 minutes. It's going to be a really short interview.
I will watch the rest of it. I'll force myself to watch the rest of it. So,
we won't tell anybody what it is just yet. No. I must admit, I have to go back and rewatch it as well. So, sure, we'll do that.
Okay.
All right. So, thanks, David.
No worries.
See you again.
Catch you again in a couple of weeks. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Thanks.